Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save, with customised coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh, yeah, nice, the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save, with customised coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh, yeah, nice, the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Welcome to You Had to Be There, the podcast where we deep dive into the world of concerts, musicians, the music industry, and so much more. I'm your host, Julia Gomberg. This week, I had the opportunity to chat with someone I really admire, Brittany Spanos, a senior writer at Rolling Stone. We got to talk about her knowledge in music, fandom, and what it's like to have a career covering some of the biggest artists in the world. Her cover stories have featured interviews with Dua Lipa, Chappell Roan, Adele, Cardi B, and so many more. Brittany also teaches NYU's first ever course on Taylor Swift's cultural and musical influence in music and beyond. Brittany curated a playlist with this episode that is also a must listen, so you can find her playlist in the episode show notes. Thank you so much for listening, and be sure to follow along on Instagram at the letter U, had to be their pod. You can also find me on TikTok at the letter U, had to be their pod. Thanks again. Catch you next time.
My name is Brittany Spanos, and I am a senior writer at Rolling Stone.
Yeah, I reached out to Brittany because I work for the parent company of Rolling Stone. Like I mentioned before we started recording, I've been like a fan of your work. I have the copy of the Dua Lipa interview sitting in front of me right now. I was excited to see that, like, kind of reading your background, like you're a big pop girl yourself. Can you kind of talk about your relationship with music growing up?
Yeah, I grew up in, I guess, like a family of people who had like big music obsessions. Like no one played music or no one worked in the music industry in any way. Like they were just like people who had like super fandoms of certain artists. So like, my grandpa was really obsessed with Elvis, and my mom was obsessed with Michael Jackson and Prince as a kid, and then like was a huge like Alanis Morissette fan as an adult. Mm-hmm. And my dad is like a huge Metallica fan and huge metalhead. So, like, I grew up with people who, like, were very, very much obsessed with the music they loved. And, you know, just it was always on, like, you know, in the house or in the car. So very, very big music fans. And I myself just, like, loved everything that they loved. But I also started to form my own taste as I entered elementary school and was a huge fan of like, boy bands of, like, NSYNC and Backstreet Boys and totally. Sort of the bubblegum pop of the early 2000s I was really obsessed with. So, yeah, I think I was always just, like, really, like, kind of, like, easily attached to fandom before I even knew what that word meant or what it was. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as I kind of, I hate to use, like, grew out of boy bands, but I think, like, once they all started to break up and, like, they all right. started to grow up, I got more into pop punk and grunge, and I think getting down the rabbit hole of like rock history and getting really into like 90s music and especially bands that didn't exist anymore, like Nirvana and things like that, like led me eventually to figuring out that there are music magazines that like published a lot of interviews with those bands, and I would read them, and mm-hmm. eventually learning that that's a job you could do. And I think it was really just like in middle school starting to get into like reading about music and reading books about music and reading magazines and subscribing to Rolling Stone and Spin magazine and yeah. watching Almost Famous. I was like, oh, that's a job I could do. And so that's the path that was how I was set on this path, was really in middle school, just like realizing that I can turn being a nerd into a career.
what a time to, I think we are similar ages because I definitely like Backstreet Boys, NSYNC. That was my jam too. Like the, like listening on your Walkman and like the car, that kind of a thing. Yeah. And I think that like energy just sticks with you. And like, we were just really lucky that that was such a peak time for like pop music. And I like want to ask you later on, sort of like, I feel like right now we're in a pop renaissance and it's obviously very female based than what it was like with boy bands growing up. But I feel like there's such a correlation.
For sure.
Were you always interested in writing specifically?
Yeah, I mean, even before I, you know, realized that music journalist was what I wanted to do, I was a huge reader as a kid. Like, I was a very indoor kid. I loved to read. I read books all day, every day. Like, you know, I always, like, loved the idea of being an author. Whenever I had, like, a new sort of, like, you know, when you're, like, seven, like, a new career change, it was always, like, that plus author. You know, it was, like, astronaut plus author, doctor plus author. Like, I wanted to write so bad, and I just loved books, and I loved reading, and, you know, I wanted to do that. And I didn't, you know, it was, like, one of those things where I kind of, like, explored, like, fiction writing when I was a kid. I kind of, like, didn't. Right. I think it's funny, like, when I look back on those journals and, you know, my, like, you know, little short stories and, like, little, you know, little forays into fiction writing. And they were always so, like, kind of journalist-y because I'd be, like, at this time on this day and the weather was, like, it was, like, so fact-based. Like, I was so obsessed with, like, the exact facts of it, you know? Like, I was just, that's like, so I was, like, funny. Oh, maybe I just, like, always kind of needed to figure out that that was going to be what I was doing.
yeah, like it was in you and you just kind of had to shape it and that it was already kind of there. That's what I love too. Like I always love hearing like the super early stages because I think it's so innate and like it's just a matter of how you kind of unfold it and realize you're like, oh, this is totally for me. And like, I guess, like in terms of pop music and fandom, what kind of like relationship, like as you sort of realized, okay, like I'm a fan, is this phenomenon of fandom, like did you find community in that, or like what was your relationship to the fandom side of these boy bands and artists?
I mean, I'm not really, I guess, in the sense that it exists now. Like I think like it was kind of, I didn't really know like the concept of the community part of it when I was really young, because when I liked NSYNC and Backstreet Boys, and specifically even more so NSYNC, I was much like much deeper as like a super fan of NSYNC and Justin Timberlake when I was a kid. So I was ages like probably like 6 to 9 when I was really deep in that. So I had no, like, you know, like I had friends who liked it, but it was still like, you know, not like, it wasn't like a really a big thing in my school. Like I went to Catholic school and like I think like, you know, it was not really like a big sort of like boy band contingent. I think I was definitely like an outlier in being like a super fan of them. So yeah, I didn't really have like a lot of friends who like were super obsessed with them. And I didn't really know, like even when I went to the concerts, I remember always feeling like kind of young. Like my first two concerts were NSYNC and I always felt like I was surrounded by like older teen girls mostly, who were there with their friends. And it was like me and my dad, you know, so, you know, it was like, I loved seeing that though. Like I was always kind of like, I was always a little jealous, I guess, of like the idea of like, oh, like you can be like this, like older teen and you and all your friends go to this concert without any parents. And like, you're like at this show and screaming your lungs out for your favorite boy band member. So, yeah, I mean, I got to experience that obviously as I got older, but when I was first becoming a super fan of stuff, like I definitely was sort of, it was more of like a private experience.
Right. Well, I think that's even more of a testament to like your passion for it, because you weren't like following the lead on someone. This was clearly coming from your own like passion, I guess, in terms of like, okay. And then just happening to, go to the concert and be like, okay, like there's a lot of people not even like you, because like you said, you were younger, but that must, I don't know, like probably looking back, that must be kind of cool. You were like a trailblazer at like ages 6 to 9. But yeah, I was also thinking like, I was definitely more of an NSYNC person too, but what are your thoughts on like the Backstreet Boys doing their residency at the Sphere?
I really need to go. I'm like actually like really desperate to go. I've actually never seen them live, weirdly. Like I've seen so many other boy bands live, and so especially like I didn't go to like a lot of concerts when I was really young. Like the I like went to like 2 NSYNC concerts and then didn't go to any concerts until I was like in high school. And so I didn't really see a lot of that, those like pop acts live when I was a kid. So I obviously now that I'm a music journalist and like I have been able to have access to that as I've gotten older, like I made up for a lot of lost time, but weirdly yeah. have never seen Backstreet Boys. So I'm like really dying to go because I'm also dying to go to the Sphere. But right. I do think it'll be really healing to see them in that environment.
That's what I think. There's something so nostalgic and healing in that regard. And just imagining so many fans and like the, now being like probably the same age as us and like just having that such a collective moment on such a large scale. Like I can't even imagine how cool that must be.
Yeah.
Obviously, yeah, like you said, you kind of were on more of like a concert hiatus, and then as you got more into your journalism career, that's when you started seeing boy bands. Did you feel like there's similar themes or correlations of what it felt like when you were super young and like seeing these boy bands into like what maybe more recent years have had like their boy bands? Is there like a similarity, or does it feel really different because it's so more modernized, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I think like when, you know, when I had seen NSYNC, like I didn't really grasp the concept of like this like larger community that may have existed and and how people connected or how they knew each other. And so it was fun, like when I started to go, when I would see like One Direction, when I was starting out my journalism career, that was like when One Direction was starting to blow up and I covered them a lot. So I think going to those concerts like really kind of felt very full circle in a way where I was able to experience that not only as now an adult who like has those memories of going to shows when I was younger and experiencing that, but also as like a person who had friends within this fandom and like, you know, people I met through writing about One Direction. I met other like girls who were in their early 20s, like starting their journalism careers covering this boy band. Right. And like, you know, I wouldn't say I was necessarily like deep in the fandom, but like, it was like a weird sort of like mix of like fandom plus journalism where it was like other women my age who were just like starting to become writers and starting their careers. And like, we were sort of forming it around this boy band. So, you know, yeah. I think that was like kind of cool because I was able to go to those concerts with them and experiencing that. So I was like, oh, like now I'm like, you know, one of the older girls at the show with like their friends and like, you know,
totally. Like, you're like, yeah, full yeah. circle. I see.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You're like some other young girls probably looking at you and like having the thoughts that you had when you were at the NSYNC yeah. show. Yeah. That's really cool. And I also just love like as a boy band person too, like before we started recording, I said like, I'm wearing my Jonas Brothers shirt. I was like in that era. Like, yeah. I think there's something so validating of like fan girls, even though that sounds somewhat derogatory, it's like them being such influential parts of the music industry and parts of, you know, artist success. And it's like, even at you mentioned, it's like female journalists, that's such a validating feeling, I feel like, because there is this, I think like we've modernized and people now kind of see fangirling differently, but there's always been that kind of like connotation to it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's definitely interesting. And especially today in like the scope of how pop music is really being led by women, I kind of want to go into that, but I'm kind of jumping ahead also. I want to ask more about how you sort of ended up at Rolling Stone. So yeah, like once you started entering like college, like did you have a more structured idea of this is what you really wanted to do and specifically like music journalism?
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty structured well before that. Like, I think, like, literally when I was in middle school, I was just like, I'm going to work at Rolling Stone one day. And it was pretty much, like, the only thing that I worked towards. And so, you know, like, middle school, high school, I started to write more and started to, like, you know, like, do, like, school papers and like, you know, like, the school paper and, like, you know, write reviews and like, album reviews and whatever, like, you know. Interviews and things like that and took like summer courses and journalism and things like that. And I always knew I wanted to move to New York and make it happen. So yeah, I went to NYU for undergrad and my major was in the Gallatin School of Individualized Studies. So it was like literally music journalism.
Oh, amazing.
And
yeah.
Took a lot of music history classes and also like kind of widened it, which I'm glad I did, like took like film history and theater history and, you know, performances, you know, it's like a lot of like cool sort of like arts criticism classes that went beyond just music and, you know, pop music history. So I think that was really important for it. And yeah, like I got an internship at the Village Voice my junior year. And what was great about being at a place like the Village Voice was that it was pretty loose. Like it was like, you know, pretty unstructured in how the internship worked. So I kind of just like stayed there for a really long time. Awesome. And became like a contributor. And they like, you know, I started to like do like this like weird sort of like fake editorial assistant job that they paid me weekly for, and like also got to write a bunch, freelanced a bunch, like did Rookie Magazine. And that was a really cool way to meet a bunch of women in the music industry who were working at Rookie as well, like Jessica Hopper and Julianne Escobedo Shepherd. They were contributors for Rookie and editors for Rookie, and also are incredibly iconic music journalists who were writing for like Pitchfork and for Rolling Stone and for Spin and all these publications I wanted to one day be able to write for. And so they helped connect me with editors and were super supportive. And yeah, that's sort of eventually ended up at Rolling Stone just through like literally meeting people through the Village Voice and Rookie Magazine, you know, and amazing. Also just being like a very, very, very active freelancer and writer. So I was literally covering concerts like most days of the week and doing all of that. So yeah,
that's amazing. And like, yeah, I think connections are a big part of it, but it's also so powered and fueled through personal determination. Like you had such a specific like path in your mind. And I think it's no coincidence that you like ended up connecting with those types of people, because it's really your passion that's like driving you to get there.
Yeah.
And how, so when you like got to Rolling Stone, did you sort of have like a moment where you're like, wow, I made it. This is where I saw myself. Like when I was in the crowd at NSYNC, like, did you have that aha moment?
Yeah. I mean, I think like it happened even before I like even got the full-time job, because I started freelancing. Mm-hmm. Like maybe like 6 months before. And I remember like my very first freelance assignment for Rolling Stone was like literally the weekend I graduated from college. And it just felt so like satisfying. Like it was just like, oh, like I just like I'm doing it now. Like it's like really like I have my first assignment for Rolling Stone. I just graduated from NYU, like just like in it now. Like I'm just doing it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that's kind of when it started. And then, you know, I felt just like very, very blessed to be able to get there. Like, you know, I started 2015, so it was like, you know, 6 months after I graduated from college I went full-time there. And so just felt really like cool and I think like overwhelming, because I think in my vision of like when that would happen, obviously when I was like, you know, in middle school I was like, it's gonna happen when I'm 15 like and almost famous. But then I was like, and then I went to college, I was like, okay, that's not realistic, but I was like, maybe one day like I can work towards this, and maybe like by like my 30s I'll be able to like write covers for Rolling Stone and like be full-time there. And so it was like really cool that everything kind of happened way earlier than I anticipated, but like
that is surreal. But also like, again, like I just think it makes sense, like based on just what you're saying and how it like it's so innate for you.
Yeah,
I guess like, so yeah, you were contributing, you obviously covered a lot of shows. Yeah. Is there a type of editorial that you like doing the most?
I love writing profiles. I love doing interviews. I think that's like my number one.
Yeah.
My first cover was Cardi B in 2017. And that one was like, it was just like a whole like journey to it, because I was like 25 at the time. And so I was just like, I had never written a cover, and like I had never written a long form anything at that point. And also like, especially at that time, like I think they really, you know, there's like the same like three or four people who got all the cover stories there. It was like a pretty like a limited pool of people writing them at the time. So, you know, I was like 2 years in at the job. Like I was wondering at that point, like what will it look like for me to move up? What would it take to like be able to get to that point?
Yeah.
Because once you're inside, it's different than when you're outside. You're like, okay, like, is this like actually possible? Like, is it just going to be like, you know, a long, you know, slog to like getting to that point.
Right.
Cardi was someone I had been covering since she was on Love and Hip Hop and started her like started to release mixtapes. And so I had done like an interview with her, you know, like a year before Bodak Yellow came out and she blew up. Wow. And yeah, so I had been covering her pretty closely. And so literally was doing like what was going to be a short like in book interview with her because Bodak Yellow had just come out and like we were like, okay, like let's like get her in book and like the song was already doing really well. And then it went number one while we were like working on an issue that like someone else was supposed to be on the cover. And then I think they had dropped and like, then they're like, let's bump Cardi up. And so they were just like, do you want to do it? So I was just like, okay.
Oh my gosh.
And also I'd already done interviews with her. Like, so they were just like, it would have been crazy for them to have like reassigned it like in the middle of it. But I also kind of was just like, maybe they just will. Like, I was just like, I don't know. Like, are they gonna like let me do this? So yeah, so that was really cool. That was like my first one. It happened really quickly. And yeah, it's just like a really insane process.
Yeah. What was the process like? I imagine in general, there must be like very long nights, very tight deadlines.
Yeah. I mean, at that time we were every 2 weeks at that point. And then we moved to monthly. So this was like before we were even at PMC. So like, it was Rolling Stone was like a, you know, like basically every other week. And so closing was always chaotic. And it was always like really, sometimes we would writers would have like months to work on a story, you know, if we had like a lot of advance notice or something, or like, you know, it's like a bigger artist that like is like, I want to be on the cover of Rolling Stone for my album. Sometimes be like a long process, but other times it was like, this song just blew up, like we have to get this person on here, or this thing just happened, like we have to like we have to cover this. So, you know, now the process is much different, but then it was like literally I can't even tell you like how quickly it was. Like, remember, it was a pretty, I feel like if I looked back and like found the actual amount of time that we worked on the story, it would probably shock me.
Wow.
Yeah, it was like, you know, immediately had to like go to Baltimore because she was doing like a college performance, and like went on the train, like went straight to her hotel, went to her show with her, did an interview. Like, it was just like such a quick turnaround. It was way less than a month. Like, it might have been only like 2 to 3 weeks of like trying to get it together. And luckily, like lengthwise, it was a little bit shorter than a normal cover story because it was part of the Hot issue. So it wasn't like a full like 5,000 to 6,000 word story. So that was nice. But like, I think I would have like lost my mind if I had to do like a full length cover. Gosh. So yeah, but it was definitely like a really crazy turnaround because they were trying to like be so on top of getting it out as soon as possible.
Wow, that's really crazy. I cannot even imagine the short time frame. And then like, did you feel like you were having time to sort of like process what was happening, like you were writing this cover story, or were you sort of like do you get like in a game mode when you have those tight deadlines?
I think it depends. Like, I think with that one, I don't really remember if I did. Like, I think I was just so like scared and like I think just like trying to make it good, you know. Like, I think that was like the most important thing, is I wanted to be able to do more of them. Like, I didn't want this to be my only cover, so I was like, it was more so just like I wanted the story to be done well. I didn't know what that process looked like. I was like working with the editor I never worked with before. I was like doing, like, it was just like a lot of like stress. You know, I think with other ones, like I honestly don't think like it felt like the process like got really comfortable until like the last couple of years, because there's so much technical stuff behind the scenes to make it happen that's really stressful, that like is like well before even you start writing. And so it's just like, even just like booking the story and doing the reporting is like a really insane process. So like the writing itself depends on like really how much time you get, like how much access you're able to like finagle, like all this other bullshit like behind the scenes that obviously people aren't really seeing or experiencing. Totally. Tends to affect like your mindset while you're working on the story more than anything.
Yeah, I'm really glad you said that, because I think, not to like be shady towards anyone who doesn't know much about music, but I think people do have like misconceptions of even like how albums are made or like how articles are written. Like, it's not like you're submitting an essay to your college professor and that's, you're just sitting down typing it up and that's it. Like, that's probably the, like, a fraction of all the other stuff that goes into the logistics of getting the pen on the paper.
Yeah. Yeah.
Has there been any, like, standout artists that, yeah, you remember, like, writing about that ended up being really big or having, like, big moments?
Yeah, I remember one of the very first features I produced myself was Shawn Mendes. And it was, like, one of those things where this was, like, you know, this was, like, a while ago at Rolling Stone, so I was, like, a little looser, like, in terms of, like, how everything functioned. Especially, like, the difference between, like, print and web, so I kind of was just like, I assigned it to myself. Like, I was just like, okay, like, Stitches had just come out. He had been super big on Vine. Like, I was like, just, and also because I, you know, I was on Twitter a lot and I like was sort of engaging with a lot of pop fandom. I noticed that like a lot of like the Directioner girls on Twitter were becoming huge Shawn fans. And so I was like, this guy's going to blow up. Like, he's like super cute. Like, he's like this, like, you know, teen boy who's doing this like kind of Ed Sheeran-y song, like singer songwriter vibe. Like, I'm like, he's going to be huge. And it was before Stitches even, like, really, like, took off. And so I, like, produced, like, this whole feature around him where I got, like, the video team in. I got, like, a photographer. Like, I really was, like, I really on one. Like, I was just, like, I'm doing this myself. Like, I'm, like, who cares? Like, I didn't even tell my editor. I was, like, I'm just going to let you know when it's done. And then you could, like, take a look at it. And so.
It's amazing.
And so the piece did really well. And, you know, he ended up blowing up. It was, like, the first big feature on him that had been written at that time. Like, he hadn't really done a lot of interviews. And so that was a big one where it was, like, he was on the cover, like, a year later or something. You know, I felt really proud of that one because I was just, like, I, like, produced this big Shawn Mendes feature. And, like, I, like, beat, like, The Times and, like, all these other, you know, all these other publications. And, like, I was just, like, I feel really, like, smart for doing that. And so I did that like a couple of times with stuff and was really just like proud of that. And like Hardy is obviously like again like an early example. Like Lizzo was someone I had been covering since like when Truth Hurts first came out. I, you know, covered the song a bunch and like covered her and then obviously those songs blew up like 2 years after. So there's been like a few artists like that where I'm just like, okay, like I'm really glad that I like followed that instinct when I did.
And also, yeah, it's funny you bring up Shawn and, like, Vine, because I think that was such a, like, foreshadow to the scope of the internet and TikTok and artists, you know, relationships with that platform. Yeah. I was listening to an interview with you, I think it was, like, around COVID, and you were, like, predicting a bit of, like, who, like, comes from that platform, what sticks and what doesn't, and you said, like, I think there's going to be some really, like, consistent breakthrough pop artists and who came from that platform. And I think like a perfect example is Addison Rae. You just did a cover story on her. Can you talk a little bit about like, yeah, like what's your perspective on TikTok and like how it's so much impacted music today?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just like more a symptom of how like discovery changes. So, you know, I think that the way that people find stuff changes like every few years. And it's like for a while it was like Vine and for, you know, can be Instagram or Twitter, or like any like YouTube, whatever. Like, you know, I think there's like a lot of changes that happen every few years in how people engage with like sharing stuff and like posting things and like, you know, being able to find like wider audiences. So obviously TikTok is just like that version of it now. I'm sure even in the next like year or two, it's going to change again. But, you know, it's been, I think, you know, it's a social media app that people are on like 24/7. And so obviously it's like had a huge impact on how people's like brains work, like, and how songs get spread and sort of like our associations with those songs or with those artists. So yeah, I think it's just like people, you know, are just like spending so much time on it. Like obviously it was going to impact like how artists blew up or how songs blew up or how already popular artists are able to share their music. So yeah, it's been interesting like how long it's sort of been able to keep that hold too. So I'm curious like how much longer we'll be able to.
What do you think is gonna be next? Like, do you think video form is here to stay for people in terms of like promoting and connecting with their music?
I think for now, yeah. Like I don't know like what is going to move next. I'm wondering if like more like analog stuff is going to have like a moment because I feel like people are like a little bit tired of like algorithms in a way. So yeah, I'm curious like what that's gonna look like. I feel like we might just like get really into like playlisting or something, or like bringing back like mixes in a way, because I feel like people are just kind of like want a little bit less of this like robotic curation, things that feel more personal. So yeah, I don't know. I'm curious, like, what's, I feel like there's definitely like a little bit of a fatigue there, but I do think video obviously is just like, again, just the way a lot of our brains work now. So like, I feel like it is kind of like hard to step away from it. Like, I don't know. I think it's like obviously still like a very catchy way to get people's attention. So I don't really see it going away totally, but it may shift form. If it's not TikTok, it's like, you know, people, you know, like even just like the day that like TikTok was shut down, like people immediately moved to another video app, or like they started using Reels, and like, you know, it's like they just kind of like, we all have like sort of like an addiction to like scrolling through content. So I don't know that's going to entirely move anytime soon.
That's a good point. Everyone was like not accepting it. They were like jumping ship immediately. I remember like that night I was just staring at my phone and being like, wait, do I go to Red Note? Like, what do I do? I'm also like, feel personally validated by that, because I'm intentionally not doing video for my podcast. Like, I've never been the type to watch podcasts, and I mean, that's totally a personal choice, and I think I'm putting a huge challenge on myself, because I still have to make content for social media, and I'm like, how do I do that? That doesn't feel like it's like AI or something. Do you feel like in terms of like community, like the internet has been a big reason for why fandom has grown so much in recent years?
I think it's a big reason why fandom sucks now, but like, I don't think it's the reason why it's grown. Like, fandom's always existed, and I think, like, you know, there was, people found ways to build community well before the internet through it. Like, you know, there were like, for like the Beatles, like girls shared like zines and like mailed them to each other, you know, and like had meetups, and thinking about like even just like the like Star Trek fandom and like the decades that they have had like huge like conventions and things like that. You know, it's like, that's always existed both in and without, and both in and outside of music. But I think with the internet, I think it's like, there are pros to it where it's like, you're able to like really communicate and like build those communities even wider and like make friends in a really cool way and like meet people like halfway across the world. Like, I know so many people in my life who, you know, have like gone to concerts in different countries, and then like have gone with like random people that they like met someone in Germany, and like they like flew out to Germany to go see like Taylor Swift, and like went to go see the concert with them. Like, that part's really cool. I think internet has like sort of created obviously a lot of like stan wars and this competition, and I think it becomes like so much less about the actual artist or the music, and more so about like success and numbers. And I think that really is gross and sucks, because I don't think that as a fan, that should be your concern. I don't think that's what fandom is about. And like, it's not about like, is your artist number one? It's like really just like loving the music and like loving the relationships that you gained from it. Yeah. I think that part sucks, because I think it's, you know, internet and sort of this like nature of how it works now is like so much about competition. And I just like the song.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Who would you say like are the biggest rivalries in pop?
I actually don't know that there's like really like I think there's obviously periods of time where there was like actual like Lil Monsters versus Katie Katz, or like, you know, like stuff like that. But like, I actually like, it's weird, because I don't feel like there's like actual like one-to-one rivalries right at this moment. Like, I just feel like it's like your artist versus everyone else. And I think that's kind of the vibe of the last couple of years in a weird way, where like you have like your, you know, someone with like a Ariana Grande picture is like kind of in competition with everyone who's not Ariana Grande or has not shown support for her. So, you know, I think that's kind of the vibe right now. Like, there were so many periods of like the 2010s where it was like this artist versus this artist. And a lot of that came from just like those specific artists having an actual feud or like an actual like negative interaction. But now it feels like very much like anyone who's not that artist is in competition.
Yeah, that's a really good way of
unless they're like friends.
Yeah, right, right. But I'm totally imagining on Twitter like that Ariana Grande stan, just like yelling at everyone. It's like such a thing. But I think also kind of another perspective, at least like I've been seeing, you know, the pop girlies being so big, like Chapel and Sabrina and like Billy, they are such different fonts, but like they coexist really well, like more so than I feel like I've seen with other pop artists like from the 2010s. Like, do you think something has evolved in that sense where people are a little bit more like open-minded?
Yeah. I mean, I think like, I feel like I don't really like see it so much with the art, like the fans that much. With the artists, I feel like, I think maybe this is the reason why there isn't so much like one-to-one fighting anymore between fandoms is like, I think the artists, especially like the women in the music industry specifically, because they often were the ones pitted against each other. Yeah. I think they sort of came to realize how much they were becoming like weapons of the industry to like create these conflicts for their own, for like the industry's gain, and how it was kind of destroying a lot of women in the industry. And so, you know, I think for the most part, a lot of the younger girls are like, I will not be like that. There's no point in me being like that. Like, I would much rather, you know, there's like actually, like, there's like quite literally room for more than one, in a way that like, I think like a lot of patriarchal parts of like the entertainment industry and society at large, like didn't allow this idea of like more than one person existing, especially in like subgenres more than anything. There's always kind of like a woman that was sort of like meant to be elevated more than others, and we're at a point that like maybe like a few of the pros of streaming, and there are very few pros of like streaming culture because artists are not getting paid, but like you know, one of the few pros of it is the fact that it does allow a lot of people to create like much larger fan communities than previously, you know, like I feel like there's a lot of like there's people who are constantly like can sell out like, you know, a Radio City size venue or even like Madison Square Garden that don't have any hits at all, don't have any like technical sort of like top 10 hits or like aren't, you know, tabloidy or have the same coverage as other artists and still have like a giant fandom. So that's pretty cool because like, I mean, even, you know, this last year, like it's like someone like Chapel Roan a decade, two decades ago, if she got dropped from that first label, like that would have just literally been it. There would be no room for her to have grown her own fandom or be an independent artist or tour without that support. Or someone like Charlie, who is having like a career renaissance, she would have just been like a one-hit wonder in the 90s, and then there would be no sort of further interest or support in her kind of having this comeback moment. So it's cool like when you have artists who are able to like really kind of have that mix of their touring and like building a community through like being on the road, which is such an important part of that. Like you can't really have that success without that element, but through the internet and through like streaming and through like social media, they're able to like really, you know, nurture that fandom in a great way. So I think a lot of artists are like, oh yes, we can coexist and like have the success because we're not actually taking anything from each other.
Absolutely. I'm even thinking back to like, I don't know how many years ago, I guess, when Taylor Swift was in her like Bad Blood kind of reputation era, and she was out with being seen with a lot of other females, like whether in the music industry or just in the public eye, and like how that was kind of seen in a negative context, where as now it's sort of what you're saying, like I think she was sort of ahead of the game and like really normalizing that and like being like, there's room for all of us to be like successful. There's not like someone that should be on top of the other. And I know like you definitely have some history with Taylor. That sounds like not personal history, but like, like career history. I know you taught a course at NYU. Can you talk a little bit about that and sort of like how her career has impacted yours?
I've been teaching this course at NYU's Clive Davis Institute of Recorded Music. So it's like the program for students studying to be in the music industry in some capacity, mostly through performance or production. I'm teaching this semester. I taught it twice before. And the course, it's like, you know, a half semester, like music history course, really. Sort of like this like cultural biography of her where we kind of go through in chronological order her life and her career. But it's also sort of like a close analysis of certain themes that come up through different eras in her career, whether it's like feminism or celebrity or songwriting about love and relationships, or, you know, the diaristic elements of her songwriting and sort of the relationship that her music has with her own public image. Right. So yeah, so it's really interesting and fun. But yeah, I've, you know, she's someone who I've been listening to since I was in high school and have been covering since, you know, I've started writing professionally. So it was like kind of like a, one of the more like obvious artists for me to pitch a class on, because I, you know, she's someone I like talk about all the time and know too much about and think about a lot. So it's like, was a very easy class to put together.
That's so cool. Yeah. I think it kind of goes back to the beginning again of like, you have this innate passion for it and it like makes sense. It kind of unfolded from there. For someone who's like more of a Taylor skeptic, which can mean a lot of things, I guess, like, how would you argue like her impact on pop music and like the way the industry looks today?
I mean, I think she, you know, she had a pretty immediate impact from the moment she debuted. Like, you know, there it, she came onto the country scene at a time when a lot of women weren't being played on radio, or, you know, I mean, it's still a huge problem, but, you know, I think there was a right. It was sort of a very bro-y era of music, and I think it opened a lot of doors for a lot of women to, you know, find their voices, get signed, like, have, you know, more of a presence in country music. Obviously, still, there's a lot of hurdles in that, but, mm-hmm. you know, I think she did sort of, like, reopen some of those doors. I think she also really kind of forced people to take teen singer-songwriter seriously. I think the idea of like a teenager having any sort of agency in their career or in their music making is like Taylor is the only reason why we have taken artists like, you know, Lorde or Billie Eilish or Olivia Rodrigo right. seriously. I think that, you know, they would have been infantilized or seen as like these like, you know, curated machine-built sort of pop machine-built right. artists. And I think Taylor putting her songwriting at the forefront from the start of her career really had a huge impact on us being able to take those artists seriously and see them as like actual like creative beings and people who have like really adept and smart sort of pop writing skills. So I think she was very important to that, because I think prior to that it was so much like either an artist is seen as like a cog in this like industry, or, you know, kind of like a puppet,
right.
like a teen girl mostly is seen as that, or a prodigy who sort of is like a flash in the pan sort of deal, you know, mm-hmm. or like doesn't, you know,
yeah.
Taylor sort of shifted that narrative of what a teen can do.
I love that. Yeah, I think you're so right. Like when you said Olivia Rodrigo, Driver's License, I don't think would have been as big as it was if Taylor hadn't like kind of paved the way of like being taken seriously for her songwriting in that kind of romantic, whimsical way.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's why I think pop music right now also is so big in a vulnerable way that it hasn't been before.
Yeah.
Like Good Luck Babe by Chapel. Like, I don't know. Do you think someone would even like have written something like that like 10 years ago?
It definitely wouldn't have blown up. Like, I think so. Yeah. Like, I think like, of course, you know, and I think it's also like a testament of a lot of for like the moment that we're seeing Chapel. And I think she's been really good at sort of talking about this is like, there were a lot of really great queer songwriters and pop stars prior to Chapel who just like weren't able to like reach this far, and it's been like years of like really kind of like clawing at the industry and like trying and like being open and like a lot of bravery for decades that allowed sort of this moment to happen. And I mean, obviously it's also like Chapel's own sort of like, you know, years and years of like really really working at this. But yeah, I mean, like those songs existed. It's just like really incredible that one finally blew up.
Yeah.
You know, and like she, and again, like it's a mixture of that testament of like timing and like all the artists that came before her, but also like herself and her own like years and years and years of hard work.
100%. Right. It's not like she just rolled out of bed and released Good Luck Babe.
There yeah.
was like tons of history behind yeah. that. Yeah. In her career. Yeah. I'm curious to see like now that that's sort of something, especially of those themes of like discovering your sexuality and things like that, like I wonder how receptive people will be to more of that as it sort of unfolds.
Yeah.
Do you have any artists that you are like kind of in that moment right now where you're keeping your eye on, and like you maybe I'll be writing a cover story in like a year from now? And any standouts?
I'm really into this artist, Sam Austin's. He's really good. He's been around for a minute. And he has a song called Seasons that's been doing really well. And I'm curious, like, what...
I'm, like, feverishly writing this
song. I'm curious if that song's going to blow up some more, but he's going to be on tour with Magdalena Bay. But I really, really love that song. I've been obsessed with it for months, and I'm kind of hoping that it sort of, like, continues building and continues getting more attention. I've been a fan of Lola Young for a minute, so I'm happy that, like, Messy has been taking off. So I'm hoping that there's, like, even more. I'm also, like, an album that is not out yet, but I... like, obviously, you know, listened to early was coming that I think people will really get into, and I'm hoping it's like a big year for her, is Jensen McRae. Mm-hmm. I like, you know, she's been around also for a minute, and she, you know, she released her debut album a few years ago, but I think this album is going to be like a big breakthrough moment for her. And it's like so much bigger sounding. And I mean, the lead single Praying for Your Downfall is like really, really good. But it's been like on repeat. So I'm excited for people to hear that album.
That's really exciting. I also ask my guests to curate like a short playlist of songs that like they're into. Mm-hmm. So if you're down for that, I definitely will be listening to yours. This is sort of, I probably will keep it in. I'm more just asking because I like picking your brain. You're just very knowledgeable. But like in terms of like openers for tours, like I would just think of like as an example like Benson Boone being like the opener for Taylor in like London, like do you think there's a big correlation of like openers and their rise to fame?
Yeah, like I think it's a really big, I mean touring's always going to be like the biggest boost an artist can get. I think like no matter what, above all else, like experiencing music in person is always going to be like the biggest thing that you can, that can exist. Like I think if you're a really good performer, like that's gonna be like the thing that like actually builds your career. I think like it's been very noticeable that we've had like a lot of success and like artist breakthrough in the last few years because touring's been so back and so like bigger than ever, and like everyone's been on tour. I think that has clearly been like the thing that's helped a lot of artists is having that moment. I think like you know, like I think like, you know, it's like clear with like Chapel and Olivia, like the timing of Chapel being on the Olivia tour when she was like, was a big help. And like Sabrina being on the Taylor tour and like, you know, like Benson doing a couple of Eras tour shows as well. And, you know, I think like the timing of that is like, it's really hard to like not put that together because it is such like a big helpful thing. I mean, the way that we share touring videos now and like how people like really love to experience them, and like artists have found all these ways to create like sort of new and spontaneous parts of the actual shows. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that when a newer artist is like on those tours, it's a huge boost to get more eyes on them.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, and I feel like at least for like the acts that you were just talking about, like they feel really intentional in terms of like openers. Whereas before, I don't know if this is just like, because I don't know as much of like who chooses the openers, like if it's artists have more of a say now, or like I know like Chapel and Olivia like had the same producer, like there just feels like there's more of a connection of like the cohesion of who's opening for who than in the past, where like there's just more, I don't know if it's the internet, I just feel like I'm noticing more of an awareness of openers than there has been in the past.
Yeah, it feels like it's like people that the artists are actually like genuinely fans of or friends with.
Exactly, where it's not like they just met in the green room like 10 minutes before they go on or something like that.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. This was really cool. I, just as a music lover, like getting to kind of pick your brain has been really insightful. And yeah, I am really excited to keep following your career and see what's to come for you.
Thank you so much for having me. So many hours putting words in your mouth. To think I thought I almost figured you out. I can make nice, but I can make it make sense now.